It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, federal waivers allowed schools to provide universal free school meals to K-12 students, but those waivers were not extended for the upcoming school year. An expert in the field and a reporter tracking the story share the latest. First, Democrats in the U.S. Senate passed a bill over the weekend that makes some big investments to fight climate change, with some climate advocates saying it would be the most significant action the U.S. has taken on global warming to date. The Inflation Reduction Act includes billions of dollars in investments for the renewable energy industry. It also has tax credits to encourage Americans to do things like buy electric cars and make their homes more energy efficient. The House of Representatives is set to vote on the bill later this week. It's expected to pass there. If it does, some estimates say it would put the U.S. on track to lower greenhouse gas emissions by 40% compared to 2005 levels by the end of this decade. That's close to a target scientists say the world needs to hit to avoid the worst impacts of climate change. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think? Are you happy to see this bill moving forward? What do you think about the idea of using incentives to get more renewable energy usage out there? How about the fact that it doesn't include a carbon tax? Do you have a question about what it does and doesn't do? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Lisa Friedman is a reporter for the New York Times who covers climate and environmental policy. Lisa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
I want to give a listen to Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. Here he is in a press conference after this act passed the Senate after a long session on Sunday.
The Senate has now passed the most significant bill to fight the climate crisis ever. And it's going to make a difference to my grandkids. The world will be a better place for my grandchildren because of what we did today.
Before we dig into some of the specifics here, Lisa, how big a deal are climate experts saying this thing would be if it in fact gets passed by the House, signed by the president?
A very big deal. And that's both in terms of the emissions cuts and in terms of, you know, finally seeing action from Congress after decades of folks who care deeply about the threat of climate change trying to push lawmakers to take major action.
Yeah, in a recent piece on the history of efforts to pass something on climate change, you mentioned an anecdote about a president getting a report from one of his aides. The president was Richard Nixon. The year was 1969. This is a long time coming. What have been some of the biggest roadblocks to passing something on this scale?
I would say probably first and foremost, a strong, well-financed, concerted effort by the fossil fuel industry to both inject doubt as to the science of climate change and to the severity of climate change. Past that, you've had real deep divisions among lawmakers and the public about the best way to go about addressing climate change.
Now let's look into the specifics. I think a lot of the attention was on kind of the political flurry of activity through the weekend. Let's look at what ended up in here. First of all, what kind of things are there when it comes to alternative energy and the batteries needed to store and use that energy?
Sure. Well, just first to put this bill in context, the president has said he wants to cut U.S. emissions 50 to 52% below 2005 levels, that's the peak of U.S. emissions, by the end of this decade. This bill helps get the U.S. within striking distance of that goal, about 40% below 2005 levels. To get there, this bill doesn't tax industries, it doesn't penalize polluting industries, it provides incentives in the form of tax breaks, predominantly about $370 billion worth over 10 years for everything from wind and solar development to heat pumps to advanced nuclear and clean hydrogen technology to store carbon from factories and power plants and store carbon dioxide emissions and also to purchase electric vehicles and move away from gas-powered vehicles.
We are talking about the climate change elements of the act just passed by the Senate over the weekend, waiting for a vote in the House later this week. Lisa Friedman is with us from the New York Times, reporter on climate and environmental policy. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on this bill that passed the Senate, your questions about what's in it, maybe what it means to you. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. So some of this is big picture, you know, promoting industry, promoting solar panels and things like that. Some of this goes straight to consumers, as I understand it, Lisa. What kind of things would, say, homeowners or car drivers or others be able to look to in this to make decisions in the future?
Yeah, let's start with automobiles, because the tax incentive in here, $7,500 for a new electric vehicle, $4,000 for a used electric vehicle. That is a rebate that, as I understand the legislation, would be one would see at the dealership. You wouldn't have to sort of file your taxes and get that money back. You know, beyond that, for homeowners, there's a home improvement credit for energy efficiency. It would allow households to deduct from their taxes somewhere around 30% of the cost of upgrades, like heat pumps or insulation. There's also a provision to allow households to receive tax breaks if they are installing solar or battery storage systems. So there's a lot of real practical measures in here to entice both businesses and consumers to change the way they power their lives from fossil fuels to cleaner energy sources.
Now, a key figure here was Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia. He was a key player in negotiating this thing, and he got some fossil fuel related and drilling related provisions in the bill. What kind of trade-offs did the people who wanted these climate change provisions have to make here?
Yeah, there are concessions in this bill. Senator Manchin has been very clear about his strong support for a gas pipeline in his state, the Mountain Valley Pipeline. He secured a promise from Democratic leaders that a separate bill later this year will include provisions to complete that project, which has been held up with permits and in the courts. In this reconciliation package itself, which couldn't contain the pipeline provision because of the unique way that it's written, there were provisions to ensure that there will be continued oil and gas drilling leasing in the Gulf of Mexico, in Alaska's Cook Inlet, and on federal lands as well. This will essentially make it impossible for President Biden to fulfill a promise he made during the campaign to end new oil and gas leasing on federal lands and waters. It's also something that is really of deep concern to a number of environmental advocates who want to end new fossil fuel development.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good afternoon. I got to tell you, I could not be more excited about what this is going to mean to me in my life and my life, but also for our country and for the state of Wisconsin. This investment in the electrical industry, and I work in the electrical industry, is going to be a good thing, not only for our environment, but it'll be good for innovation. And I've spoken with auto manufacturers at car shows and dealerships themselves, and they're already psyched about getting the infrastructure into people's homes and, you know, getting people into these electric cars. You can live in Minneapolis or Chicago, and you have a 300-mile range. You could be a commuter and use one of these vehicles for your running your errands, bringing your kids to school. It's very practical, and it's going to help our environment. I couldn't be more excited.
Jeff, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. I think, Lisa, the hope, and I think this is part of the bill too, is that it goes beyond the commuters and that range. Part of the effort, and this is, there's been some stuff from the Biden administration already trying to make sure that there's charging and better range for electric vehicles as well.
You're absolutely right. And you know, you asked me earlier about sort of the history of this, and I would say that, you know, for a long time, those who wanted to address climate change were focused on a tax on carbon polluting industries. Increasingly, folks who are working on this issue, and you see from the Biden administration, they decided that the winning strategy was going to be carrots, not sticks, incentives to change the economy, to incentivize, as the caller mentioned, innovation. And that seems to have been the key to this working politically, and is certainly leading to a lot of, you know, excitement in clean energy sectors.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. We're talking to Lisa Friedman, reporter for the New York Times, who covers climate and environmental policy, with us today to talk about the climate provisions in the Democrats' Inflation Reduction Act, how meaningful they might be for U.S. efforts to fight climate change. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of what you've heard and seen about this bill so far? Too far? Not enough? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're picking up our conversation about legislation from Democrats passed the U.S. Senate, going to the House later this week. Part of it making big investments aimed at combating climate change. Lisa Friedman from the New York Times Climate Desk stays with us. And there's still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls. Dan is with us in Eau Claire. Dan, hi.
Yeah, hi. Just wondering if anybody's looked up how cold will it get after we change to all electric vehicles?
How cold, you said, Dan? Dan, thanks for the call. Lisa, looking at the temperature impact, as I understand it, these changes at this point are slowing down the rate of temperature increase, annual temperature increase, more than cooling it back down. Am I right at this point?
That's right. I mean, a lot of global warming is baked into the atmosphere from decades already of emissions. Slowing down the rate of emissions will in turn slow global warming. The countries under the Paris Agreement and later last year in Glasgow agreed to try to keep global temperature rise from exceeding 1.5 degrees from pre-industrial levels. We're now at about 1.1. So that is the goal of you know, keeping global temperatures below 1.5, which scientists say is a threshold beyond which the consequences of climate change, floods and wildfires and droughts, et cetera, become much more severe.
Thanks for the call. Mary joins us next in West Allis. Mary, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to call. Thank you so much for accepting my call. A year ago, I actually called in. We relocated to Lisbon, Portugal, and we hadn't been back for a year. We're back in West Allis now. But I have to tell you how life-changing it is having the European style of travel. We live in the city center. It is our life to use the metro, the buses, the streetcars. Everything is walkable. We live with no car, and probably other than one time have even wanted to have a car. And, you know, as far as like climate change and all of that, you know, getting in an electric car to do your errands when you have such a sprawled out kind of community might be something that electric cars can help, but I think it is really a mindset change.
Mary, welcome back. I do remember your call, I think, when you went to Lisbon. Thanks for checking back in with us. Mary saying, you know, maybe less of a car-centric economy in the first place. Lisa, I don't think that is really part of this bill.
It's not, but I mean, certainly, you know, and yes, of course, you know, urban planning and how we arrange our communities is a much larger conversation and you know and policy issue, but you know, public transportation is better for climate change than even electric cars, and you know, where that's possible, I salute you for being able to do it.
Mary, thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. Sharon joins us now in Minocqua. Sharon, hi.
Hi. Thank you very much for letting me, that's my question, but I also have a comment, too. First off, this is wonderful news, and I am wholeheartedly, I'm actually surprised that this is getting passed in the Senate. Fingers crossed it'll pass in the House. But I do have, if we are to transition off of fossil fuels, it will have ripple effects and impacts on other sectors and other industries. So much of the byproducts of fossil fuels go into things like plastic production, which is essential in many industries like healthcare. And we also produce so much synthetic nitrogen, byproduct of fossil fuels. In addition, coal is still an essential component of steel making. So how do we address those impacts by transitioning off of fossil fuels? Does this act include research and funding for creating those alternatives?
Interesting. Sharon, thanks for the call. Lisa, I think we think of the energy use of these fossil fuels. Sharon pointing out there's a lot of other stuff they do too. Is this on the radar?
It's certainly on the radar. There is a lot of money in this bill for advanced manufacturing, for research. And I know that the Department of Energy has been doing a lot of research into alternate uses for fossil fuels. I think, one of the other things that that's important to note about this bill is that, as the caller mentioned, there's also a concern about the communities that have been dependent on fossil fuels and that have provided the energy that has powered our country for decades. There is quite a lot of money in this bill, both from, that Senator Manchin and others work to get to help, for example, site renewable energy manufacturing factories in former coal fields. Those kinds of things to make sure that fossil fuel communities are not left behind.
Thanks for that call, Sharon. Cindy joins us next in Belleville. Cindy, hello.
Hello. I'm so glad to talk with you today. As we speak, the solar installers are here at my house installing the panels.
Wow.
So our system does not yet include a battery system. And I'm wondering about the battery incentives that will be coming in this act and when they will be kicking in. And so how long we should wait before planning on adding batteries to our solar system.
Oh, interesting, Cindy. Do we have that kind of timeline on this yet, Lisa?
I have to admit, I don't know the answer to that question on the timeline. There is funding in the bill for battery development, and especially for battery manufacturing, obviously in the U.S., which has been a huge priority of lawmakers. I don't know the timing question for you offhand. I apologize.
Well, Cindy, thanks for the call. And I'm sure when this passes the House and gets signed, they'll start hammering some of that out. And we got an email from Matt in Madison who writes, "What good is any of this progress on climate change when Republicans will just nullify it when they take power?" Now, Lisa, there's been a lot of back and forth with executive actions on climate change between Republican and Democratic presidents. Does this nail things down a little more, passing it, assuming it passes the House, passing it through Congress?
It's a great question because, I'm sure that the past many years has been confusing for a lot of people as we've been covering this boomerang of, Obama administration doing X and Trump administration pushing back and doing Y. This, if it indeed passes the House and is signed by the president, will be legislation that, unlike regulation, cannot be easily undone by a president. It would require another act of Congress to undo these measures. Once Congress gives something, look at the ACA. It is hard to undo things, even when there is opposition. The bottom line is, if this indeed passes and is signed by the president, it will have a staying power that regulatory efforts have not had and would not have.
One more piece of the puzzle here that came up, and at least some of your coverage on this, Lisa, is what this means for the international climate change scene. You wrote that, in effect, a lot of countries are saying, why are we going to go through the expense of doing this if the United States isn't going to do it. How big an impact could this have on that kind of thinking?
You know, time will have to tell, but you know, it seems very significant. I mean, what, you know, I've been to now 10 UN climate conferences. I've covered Glasgow and the Paris Agreement. And there's been one constant, which is when the US doesn't act, other countries hide behind the United States. And, you know, the biggest emitter now, China, other big emitters, India, Brazil, the excuse of the US not acting won't be there anymore. There will still be questions for the United States. Getting to 40% is not 50. By many arguments, the United States, the biggest historic emitter in the world, should be doing even far more than that. There is money that the US and other developed countries have promised to help the poorest countries move away from fossil fuels themselves. A lot of that has not materialized. So there are still a number of issues in the international arena, but certainly the US now, by all accounts and the folks that I've spoken to, has a much stronger argument to make to other big emitters in trying to get them to step up their ambition.
Lisa, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Lisa Friedman, reporter for the New York Times, who covers climate and environmental policy. She was with us today to talk about the climate change provisions in the Democratic bill known as the Inflation Reduction Act. It passed the U.S. Senate over the weekend after a marathon session. The U.S. House is scheduled to vote on it later this week, where it's, at least for now, expected to pass. Coming up after the news, as kids get ready to go back to school, some school nutrition programs are going to expire or change. We'll find out what's in the works with a new report from Wisconsin Watch. Then a researcher joins us with a look at the impact of universal free lunch programs on learning and on discipline in schools. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to the author of a new book looking at the role of motherhood in society, who says it serves as a form of undervalued labor. Now, federal waivers allowing all schools to participate in universal free school meal programs came to an end on June 30th. The waivers, which gave free meals to any K-12 student in a participating school during summer and the academic year, began as an emergency response to COVID-19. Advocates for the program are fighting for legislation to keep it going, especially as some families report they're left with uncertainty about the best way to manage finances and food as the school year approaches. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a parent who benefited from these federal waivers? Did your school use this program to say, hey, anybody who wants a meal gets a meal, no need to provide proof of low income? Do you want it to continue, or do you think it was an emergency measure and the main emergency has passed? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Erin Gretzinger is a reporting intern for Wisconsin Watch. She recently co-wrote an article with Maddie Bergstrom for Wisconsin Watch on universal school meals. Erin, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what's going to look different for parents and kids in this fall's back to school when it comes to the availability of these lunches?
Right. So all Wisconsin schools operating federal food service programs offered free meals through the seamless summer option through the 2021-2022 school year. And many schools in the 2020-2021 school year also offered free meals through a federal waiver. So many schools in Wisconsin for the first time in 2 years won't have that option since that waiver has now expired and legislative efforts to replace or reinstate it have stalled. This is going to have a really big impact on students, families, and schools themselves. We know that keeping kids fed has an impact on their performance in school. School meals are linked to more children eating at school, kids being less likely to skip breakfast, and also improve improvement in school attendance. And additionally, without the application process last fall, families didn't have to apply for free school meals, and it was treated like anything else, a part of the school day, which helped alleviated stigma. And free meals allowed families typically on the fringe of qualifying for meals, or otherwise financially struggling families to receive these meals. And we saw in Wisconsin that this contributed to a boost in participation in school meals, and particularly in breakfast, which is a huge feat for the state, since we're normally one of the worst ranking states in terms of breakfast participation. And like I said, schools also benefited from universal free meals, since it decreased some administrative burdens in administering the meals, since students got them like anything else a part of the school day. So overall, there's going to be a lot of changes without that this fall, since families will once again have to qualify, and we'll see some of those benefits of the school meal experiment fade away.
And your article highlights one Wisconsin woman's story about her experience with food insecurity after being furloughed, a common experience at the outset of COVID. Can you share some of her story?
Yeah, absolutely. So the family that we feature in the story is from Waukesha, which was actually the only school district in Wisconsin to initially opt out of the free meals program in the 2021-2022 school year. The family that we featured in the story, they had faced layoffs and income shocks, a situation we know that many people in Wisconsin went through, especially at the start of the pandemic. And this shows in food insecurity numbers themselves. Feeding America's numbers from Wisconsin show that 40% of people who use food pantries during the pandemic were using them for the first time. So the situation the Goodmans were facing, the family we highlighted, was something we can see was a common theme throughout Wisconsin and the country. So the Goodmans, they used any assistance they could use, including free school meals. And what they found is that lunch money really added up to make a big difference. And this family, particularly without the free meal program this fall, they're worried about paying for food amid record high inflation. And other families will be grappling with that as well across Wisconsin.
Talking to Erin Gretzinger with Wisconsin Watch, looking at changes in school nutrition programs. Schools, many schools that were able to provide free school meals to all students without proof of low income. That program's expired, so it'll look different in many schools this fall. You can join in at 800-642-1234, maybe with your experiences. Whether you work at a school, you send your kids to school, you go to school as a student yourself. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Erin, in your reporting, what have you heard from Wisconsin schools with this change looming next month?
Yeah, absolutely. So we heard just from talking to the Department of Public Instruction that they received a lot of reports from schools about how free meals really made a difference in their ability to reach students, because it eased this administrative process. Schools didn't have to keep track of which students had money in their account or if they qualified for free and reduced meals. It also addressed the issue of school meal debt, and an estimated 3/4 of schools across the country report school meal debt, which cuts into their own budgets and abilities to provide food service programs. Another big thing we heard from schools was that this curbed a practice known as lunch shaming. And one way in which this manifests is how that schools give students alternative meals, such as cheese sandwiches, when the money in their school meal account runs out. And this can subject students to stigma, because if you see a kid in the lunch line with a cheese sandwich, it immediately points them out as not being able to afford that school meal. So we see the support from schools also manifesting in the Healthy School Meals for All campaign, which was launched in coordination with legislation proposed in Wisconsin last fall that never made it out of committee, but would have provided additional state reimbursements in addition to federal reimbursements. So to incentivize schools in Wisconsin to provide free meals. And this coalition has several school districts signed on, as well as 50 supporters overall.
Now, you mentioned there was some controversy in the Waukesha School District when they didn't want to pick this up. There has been opposition to this, saying too much federal control over these programs. And of course, now that students are in school, the at-home learning has ended, the need for this program isn't there. Can you talk about the other side of this a little bit, why some people are ready to see this expire?
Yeah, I think Waukesha is a really interesting case, and it actually became kind of the epicenter of this debate over universal free meals in the nation. Like I said, Waukesha was the only district in Wisconsin to initially opt out of the free meal program in 2021-2022 school year. And this decision received national attention after it was picked up by the Washington Post. One school board member we talked to said he received over 500 emails over the incident. And it led to, you know, rallies in the community, and it received media inquiries from all over the world, including Moscow. And just in general, the opposition surrounding this is kind of, as you alluded to, that potentially this was a federal emergency provision. We also heard concerns specifically from school members that, or school board members, when this became a heated debate, that this was a program that would be used to feed all children, even those who didn't need the free meal program. Like, for example, if you could afford to pay for free meals, why would you accept the free meals? And that was one point of debate. And then another issue too is just how this became politicized in Waukesha. And there was also comparisons to other debates about CRT and other issues that were predominant on school boards across the country during the pandemic.
And Aaron, what are you watching for next on this school meal story?
Yeah, so like I said, in the fall, schools will once again be subject to free and reduced lunch applications. So it'll be a process for schools to get those applications back out to families, to be alerting them of this change, as this has been the system for 2 years. So seeing how that rollout goes out and making sure that families understand the application process more generally. As I mentioned earlier, there is legislation in Wisconsin called the Healthy School Meals for All Act, which was authored by 30 Democrats in the Wisconsin legislature. And that seems to still be on the table and getting some momentum potentially into this fall. So keeping an eye on that bill and seeing if free meals does become a reality in Wisconsin.
Aaron, thanks for joining us today.
Yes, thanks for having me.
That was Aaron Gretzinger, reporting intern at Wisconsin Watch, with us today to talk about her reporting on the end of a universal free school meal program that's federally funded and how it'll affect Wisconsin. Coming up, we'll talk to a researcher who looks at the impact of providing meals in schools, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think it's a good idea to offer free meals to all students, or should it be need-based? Should it be something that's available to every district or just ones with a lot of need? What questions do you have about the impact of all this? What experiences do you have to share? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. As we just heard, federal waivers that allowed universal free school meals for all students are coming to an end. Our next guest has researched the impact of expanded school nutrition programs on learning and discipline in schools. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want free meals available in more schools to all students, or should it just be need-based as it was in many places before the pandemic? Has this all affected your life one way or another? You're a student at school, you're a parent of said student, you're a teacher, a school staffer. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Krista Ruffini is an assistant professor at Georgetown University's McCourt School of Public Policy, researching how government policies affect the labor market, education, and health outcomes. Krista, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Well, this change hasn't happened yet, so it's maybe hard to study the impact, but you've done some before and after studies looking at the impact of providing meals to all students. What kind of things have you learned from the past?
Yeah, that's right. So I've done a whole host of research that has evaluated an earlier form of school-wide free meals called the community eligibility provision. So under the community eligibility provision, schools and districts in which there's already a large share of students that are receiving free meals because they're eligible to receive other forms of income assistance, these schools and districts can just offer school-wide free meals to all of the students. And so there's a lot of variation in when schools and districts decided to start this program. Part of this is due to the federal legislation and when states were eligible, And then as the program has developed, more and more states have, or schools and districts have opted in. And so I've looked at the effect of this program on academic achievement, on student discipline, and on the use of community food resources, namely food banks. And what I find is really some meaningful benefits across the board. So we see improvements in math performance, especially for Hispanic and white students. I see reductions in out-of-school suspensions, especially for younger white male students. And there's also reductions in food bank usage. And importantly, all of these benefits are going to be concentrated in the schools and districts in which there weren't that many kids that were receiving free meals before the universal provision became an option.
And something I should clarify for my own benefit, because I kind of, my head's spinning a little bit with the changes. Even after this universal thing goes away, that community program where schools with high levels of students who are eligible for free and reduced lunches can provide lunches to everybody, they, correct me if I'm wrong, still get to keep doing that, right?
Yeah, 100% correct. So there's, even though the federal kind of universal waiver of universal meals has expired, there's still a bunch of options that schools and districts have for those areas that are interested in continuing some form of universal school meal. So community eligibility provision is one, provision two is another, but importantly, all of these pre-existing programs are only available to areas that are kind of high poverty to begin with.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jill is with us in Kimberly. Jill, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Jill?
Well, I want to speak as a kindergarten teacher and as a parent. I know that it's a lot easier to have free lunch for everybody. We have seen in the past that even some families that qualify for free and reduced lunches don't do the paperwork, or you know how life gets busy and you get behind things, and so they let their lunch account get behind or fall into the negative. And it's embarrassing for students to like try to go through the lunch line and not be able to because they're so far negative. And as a parent, for me to not have to worry about topping up their lunch account was really nice. So I really appreciated that last year it was free and reduced. Nobody had to worry about it. Everybody got healthy food. It was just a lot easier and good for the kids.
And Jill, as a, on the teacher side of your resume here, do you notice, you know, if kids are getting these meals, does it make it easier to teach them?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's just a lot easier if they aren't hungry, or with the free meals, they were also able to get breakfast last year. And that made a huge difference as well. We had more kids coming and getting breakfast and starting the day fed instead of hungry. So it was a huge benefit.
Jill, thanks for the call. Krista, your thoughts on Jill's experience?
Yeah, I think, Jill, you raise a whole bunch of really important points. And in addition to not filling out paperwork, I know, you know, when I was a child, I didn't bring my parents every piece of paper that was handed to me. But there's also kind of the eligibility only extends so far up the income distribution. So in order to be eligible for free meals, a single parent with two kids can't make more than about $30,000 a year. So that means a full-time, full-year worker earning $15 an hour isn't going to qualify for the free program. So there's a lot of families that are relatively low income but don't qualify on paper.
Jill, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Krista Ruffini from Georgetown University's McCourt School of Public Policy, looking at universal availability of free meals for students, breakfast and lunch. Still time for your calls at 800-642-1234. Krista, people might say, okay, yeah, meals are good for kids, no doubt about it, but schools have a lot of financial needs. Is this the best way to do this, given that at least some of this is providing meals for students whose families can afford to feed them?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think you raised kind of two points here. So one is that schools have a lot of costs that they have to deal with. And we heard from Aaron's reporting earlier that in many cases, just making meals available to everyone without a cost actually was cost savings in some respects. They didn't need to monitor all that paperwork and go through those administrative hurdles. Now, at the end of the day, it's still going to cost the money. And so schools and districts across the state and across the country need to ask, are the costs associated with giving the higher income kids the free meals who might not need one, are those costs greater than the cost to the other kids who wouldn't be receiving a meal but could benefit? And so there's kind of different costs and benefits that we need to weigh when we're thinking about whether we should expand this program.
Thanks for the call. Go now to Heidi in Merton. Heidi, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Heidi?
Well, I kind of find it, I'm a teacher, a former parent, the kids are out of the house now, but I find it kind of two-sided here. Here they don't want to pay for the kids' lunches, and they, you know, don't want to continue this program, but yet they're willing to take money away from the public schools for those students that want to go to private schools, and they want to pay for that. To me, that seems like a double-edged sword.
Heidi, thanks for the call. Krista, what do you think?
I have done no research on school privatization, so I don't want to speak outside of my area of expertise, but I agree that there is a lot of movement in education policy kind of across the board.
Heidi, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Tom is with us now in Madison. Tom, hello. Are you there, Tom?
I've worked as an artist in residence in many different states, and I just see this as a no-brainer. I think when you get people who oppose it, like the people in Waukesha, they are people that are putting their political identity ahead of the children's welfare and general health. I think too many times these days, a conservative is somebody who stays awake all night thinking that, wow, somebody might be getting something they don't deserve.
Tom, thanks for the call. Chris, I'm guessing from what you just said, you don't want to go outside into the world of the politics of this. But what are you seeing when it comes to whether states are trying to step in and replace what the federal government had just done?
Yeah, and I think Tom brings up an important point in that this program and making it universal has a lot of support from a lot of people. And we've seen some states either introduce, Wisconsin being one of them, legislation to continue this program on a statewide basis. And others like Massachusetts, Vermont, California have already extended it statewide. And so we see like universal programs tend to be popular. And there's good reason for that.
Thanks for the call. Heather joins us now in Madison. Heather, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, I'm a professional educator, and I was curious because if the students have participated in free breakfast programs, and there are free lunch or reduced programs as well, and there is a little bit of an increase in some of the churches in the local area communities providing like after-school meals or other after-school programs. But I do have a question. There is a kind of a national No Kid Hungry campaign that's been successful, both financially, but it's definitely in California. And as not just a contributor of the past, but talking with some other people in the state of California, most of those funds stay in the state of California just because of the size and the need. And as a person involved in different events or activities and professionals or as profession in the culinary industry as well, I've got to, is there an equivalent for the state?
Heather, I gotcha. We're just about out of time. Krista, briefly, have you seen this California thing? Are there equivalents to it elsewhere?
Yeah, I would say there's a wide array of community and local resources that really are very unique to each community and are really working very hard and doing great work to address the needs in where they're operating.
Heather, thanks for the call. And Crystal, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Been talking to Krista Ruffini, an assistant professor at Georgetown University's McCourt School of Public Policy. Krista joined us today to talk about the impact that the end of universal free school meals could have on learning and discipline in schools. a little while ago, we heard from Wisconsin Watch and reporting on this issue. They have a resource where people can text WIS Food, W-I-S Food, to 73224 to connect directly with a reporter who can answer food-related questions and help people find food resources. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, from warehouses and coffee shops to railroads and delivery companies, unions have been in the spotlight a lot this year. Get the latest on the labor movement and join in with your own experiences, maybe your questions. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Regular listeners may know that I'm a big fan of a group of brown bears in Alaska, which seems random. It is kind of random, but hear me out. These are the bears at Katmai National Park in Alaska. They have an annual fattest bear competition. The bears don't. People do online. There's a set of amazing web cameras where you can watch the bears at a waterfall catching salmon. I'm hooked. I'm telling everybody about this. So that's why I'm excited about the show. Tomorrow, we're going to have one of the rangers from Katmai on the show to tell us about the brown bears, the salmon, the falls, the webcams, the whole deal. If you want to get a head start, search for Brown Bear Camera Brooks Falls and start watching, then learn more tomorrow on the show. It's nature news you can use. This is Central Time.